Today, we hear from people in the Bahamas who survived one of the worst storms in history. And did Boris Johnson mislead the Queen over the suspension of Parliament? Hurricane Dorian, which has destroyed parts of the Bahamas, was one of the worst storms in history. After it hit last week, Guardian reporter Oliver Lachlan travelled to the capital, Nassau, and began trying to reach the worst affected islands. Access seemed impossible until an unlikely solution presented itself. An offer of a lift on a Royal Caribbean cruise liner called the Symphony of the Seas. Ollie boarded with a group of journalists and NGO workers and found himself surrounded by tourists enjoying luxury holidays.
Yeah, it was a pretty surreal thing to see, I guess. You know, one minute you're sitting in a luxury cruise liner watching people eat their lobster dinners. The next minute you're out there looking and speaking to people who have lost absolutely everything.
The Bahamas is a popular destination for cruise ships. Its golden sandy beaches led to it being described by a NASA astronaut as the most beautiful place from space.
Tonight, a desperate rush in the Bahamas, where thousands are stranded on the islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama.
But now a huge recovery effort is underway. At least 50 people have died and thousands are still missing, with rescuers hunting under rubble for signs of life. Those who have managed to survive have lost everything. What they are left with is questions about how to rebuild their lives in a world where the warming climate means storms like this are certain to get worse. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, reporting from the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian.
The moment we got off the little dinghy that took us out to the port, we jumped in a taxi and drove about 60 miles inland to a place called High Rock.
High Rock, one of the worst hit towns on Grand Bahama.
Which is where the eye of the storm passed through on Grand Bahama.
Downed power lines snake across the road.
And it was a scene of absolute and complete total devastation.
Homes appear to float in the water, buildings and trees torn apart.
There were houses reduced to rubble. All the municipal buildings had been completely flattened. The trees had been shorn of their leaves.
I've left behind a surreal landscape of boats and vehicles and rooftops and kitchen appliances swirled in the air and flung across the land.
The highway in certain parts had been ripped up from the ground and strewn all over the place. There were small puddles of bronzed water where fish were still swimming inside. It's a scene that I've never seen before, and I've covered a few hurricanes over the past few years. There was a kind of ghostly silence along the highway, which is normally quite a busy highway. And you're immediately drawn to the fact that a lot of people are no longer there. There are still hundreds, if not thousands, of people missing in the Bahamas. But also really just slightly, I guess, in awe of the power of nature. I mean, this was a Category 5 hurricane that basically has destroyed swathes of communities all along the affected regions.
Oliver, when did the storm make landfall in the Bahamas?
Hurricane Dorian hit the Bahamas at 11 a.m. 1st of September as a Category 5 hurricane, which is obviously the strongest form of hurricane there is.
It is the strongest storm on the planet this year, and right now it's lashing the Bahamas, Abaco Islands, after making landfall there just the last hour.
It had rapidly intensified out at sea. And basically, when it gets to the Abaco Islands and to Grand Bahama, it stalls there for 2 days over the island.
We start with breaking news this morning. Hurricane Dorian, doing something hurricanes rarely, if ever, do, is completely stalled. Look at the radar, essentially just spinning in place.
The Bahamas are being devastated by their strongest storm ever. Hurricane Dorian has been pummeling the islands for more than 24 hours now.
Which is really part of the reason why you're seeing the level of destruction that you are, because these were sustained 185 mile an hour winds that were pummeling the same region for 2 days straight. So the Bahamas is an archipelago made up of hundreds of small islands. The area that was most affected by Dorian is the northwestern part.
Thousands are stranded on the islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama.
It's the area of land that's probably closest to the United States. So we're talking about the Abaco Islands, which has a population of about 20,000 people, and Grand Bahama Island, which has a population of about 50,000 people.
This incredibly powerful storm, how prepared were people on the islands for it?
So this is an area of the world that is used to hurricane warnings. It's used to hurricanes occasionally hitting the land. And I think for a lot of people that you spoke to there, they were basically convinced they'd be able to ride it out as they have been able to do in the past. And what characterized, what was different about this storm was just the way in which it rapidly increased in speed. And so a lot of people I spoke to, people who stayed behind, were completely shocked at the intensity of what they went through.
Here's the satellite shot taken at the height of the storm yesterday. You can see that storm surge sweeping across the island.
So I spoke to some people who would say an hour before the storm surge came into their homes, they were fine. And then within a couple of hours, it was up to their roofs.
And must have been speaking to you in still complete shock at how it happened.
Absolutely, yeah. People were talking to me as they were trying to rebuild what they had left, trying to salvage whatever they could before they evacuated.
And can you tell me about some of the people that you met and spoke to?
As we pulled into the town of High Rock, most houses had basically been completely reduced to their concrete foundations, and you'd see people's belongings strewn all over the place. And as I approached the shoreline, I met a guy called Joey Saunders, who was a local pastor.
Within 10 minutes, the second floor was full of and about 20 minutes more, the third floor.
Who told me that he had spent the entire storm, so 2 days, clinging on to the branches of a mango tree, where he sat for 48 hours without food or water, worrying that his son had died, who was luckily alive, but had been also clinging onto a tree nearby that he couldn't see because the winds and the sea rise was so much.
So you got swept away in the water?
Yes, in the truss.
And you grabbed onto a tree?
No, I didn't know how it happened, supernaturally.
You just ended up in a tree?
2 o'clock and you can't see anything.
And he described to me this feeling of thankfulness that he had made it, but complete confusion and sadness about what happened next. And I asked him what he thought about while he was clinging onto that tree for 48 hours. And he said he was so afraid that he basically couldn't feel anything anymore.
God, yeah, I'm trying to even imagine how you managed to keep the strength to hold on for that long. Could he even recall that, really?
I think when you speak to a lot of people there, because Pastor Saunders' story was not unique, unfortunately. There were lots of people who had basically had to weather the storm outside and cling on to what they could in order to survive. A lot of people talk about their deep faith. The Bahamas is very religious. So that's what he spoke about. He told me he just thought about God, basically, and hoped that it would pull him through.
And you spoke to people who were looking for missing loved ones.
So another resident of High Rock that I met was a guy called Ishmael Lang. He was a 69-year-old engineer, and he was one of the people who had built his house in a way to prepare for storms like this.
When I built this house many years ago, my father, who was a builder, he said, boy, you better build strong and what have you. Say, we won't build it, be solid.
So he built it on a hill, so it was slightly higher than many of his neighbours' homes. And he described to me watching the storm surge, even on his higher home, rush into his house.
And when I saw the water went over all those buildings in front of me and came in here at 6 feet, I started to get a little shaky, but I stood strong.
But he watched out the window as the storm surge basically destroyed a number of his neighbors' homes.
My neighbor, I watched the neighbor because he spoke to me before the hurricane came. He was here on my porch. I said, well, if you have any problem, you know where to come. Mm-hmm. I thought I was in safe haven. If I didn't build on this hill, I would have been finished.
Yeah.
So he was no more. I saw the water roll over his house.
You think he's dead?
Yes, he is. Yeah, a couple of people dead.
He also said that one of his nephews had already been found dead, washed up a few miles away. And really, At the stage I saw him anyway, he was trying to clean his house, rebuild what he could, but also mourning the loss of his friends and his family too.
At this point, when you'd arrived last week, Oliver, I mean, how many were dead? What was the death toll?
So by that point, the death toll was in the 30s. It's now moved up to 43 as we're talking. But officials in the Bahamas are absolutely certain that this is going to rise. It's definitely the worst disaster to have ever hit the Bahamas. I think we don't really know what it will be in terms of the Atlantic region for a good few weeks.
The storm, as you said, was so much greater than anyone could have predicted. What has the rescue effort been like?
So it depends on who you talk to, really. The Bahamian government are trying absolutely everything they can against incredibly difficult conditions, flooding, airports that have been destroyed, to evacuate as many of the critically injured people as they could first. So there are Royal Marines on the ground there, there are US Coast Guard personnel. But when you speak to people out in places in the remote regions of Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands as well, they say that the aid is not getting there quick enough, that people are dying, that people are hungry, that they are thirsty.
No power, no water, and it's bad.
It's chaos here, and the place is uninhabitable. Nobody can live here. So we're trying to get out, and they only have limited ways of getting out here.
And the Bahamian government has committed to evacuating every single person that wants to be evacuated. There were scenes of Bahamians trying to go to the United States, but some were actually taken off the boat after they weren't able to produce valid visa documents.
We have to be very careful. Everybody needs totally proper documentation because, the Bahamas had some tremendous problems with people going to the Bahamas that weren't supposed to be there. I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come in to the United States.
So really, some people are kind of caught in a bit of a bureaucratic nightmare, I would say, when it comes to the right immigration documents and that sort of thing. Other people just complain they're not getting the basic resources that they need, food and water. But on the other hand, you've got the Bahamian government sort of saying this is an unprecedented disaster in a remote part of our country that's been incredibly difficult to access.
How hard do you think it will be for people in the Bahamas to rebuild their lives after Hurricane Dorian?
This is something that I think people are still trying to grapple with. When your entire home has been reduced to rubble, as it has thousands of people there, I think the choices are incredibly difficult and the answers are not readily available. Certainly, these two islands are a big part of the Bahamian economy when it comes to tourism, and I'm sure that some of the major resorts there will attempt to rebuild. But this is not something that's going to take months. This is going to take years. And Prime Minister Minnis has described this as generational destruction.
This is the time for us as Bahamians to show our love, our care, and our compassion for our fellow brothers and sisters.
It's kind of impossible to say exactly what the financial and economic devastation is going to be to the region.
And it's absolutely certain that the strength of these storms is increasing because of the changing climate.
So the frequency of severe hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean has roughly doubled over the past two decades. And there's no doubt in most researchers' minds that the climate crisis has a pivotal role to play in all of this. Warmer air and seawater causes storms to rapidly increase their intensity. And what we've seen over the past few years is a significant rise in the number of Category 5 hurricanes. So these are the harshest hurricanes that exist on record. There have been four in the past 3 years. And people will draw these links.
You spoke to a woman called Erica Roberts, who reflected on her own role within the climate crisis and the destruction of this storm. Who is she and what did she tell you?
Erica Roberts was a 41-year-old casino worker who lived just outside the town of High Rock. When I spoke to her, she still had cuts on her face and on her arms because she was one of those people who had had to cling on for dear life to a tree in order to escape. Her entire home had been completely destroyed. And it was one of those moments again where I thought I would ask her about the climate crisis. And she told me, without a doubt in her mind, that she thought that this whole thing was completely interlinked. She told me she spends a significant amount of her life thinking about what she can do to offset the crisis. So she recycles, she uses less plastic, she thinks about less emissions. But she's also completely cognizant of the fact that this is not really an issue that's in her control. And for somebody who had just suffered so much loss, she was still waiting to see the fate of seven of her relatives who she hadn't heard from. To talk about it in that depth was quite a confronting thing for me.
And what about the region's leaders? Do they talk about the climate crisis in this way as well?
I spoke to the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, and asked her about what she thought the links were.
Said, so we are on the front line of the consequences of climate change.
So leaders in this region have been talking about the climate crisis and how their states are some of the most vulnerable places in the world to the effects of disasters linked to climate change. The Bahamas has been subjected to severe sea level rise over the past few years, and this, according to some research, makes storm surge worse as well. But they feel consistently ignored.
And people say the words and hear you, but they don't follow through.
The Prime Minister of the Bahamas has also made calls to the international community, before Dorian hit really, to say that there needs to be more action on the climate crisis. And most leaders that you speak to, most people that you speak to on the ground, feel completely ignored.
Oliver, thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you very much.
You can read more of Oliver's reporting and follow what is happening in the Bahamas at theguardian.com. Coming up, did Boris Johnson mislead the Queen so he could suspend Parliament? Now, on Wednesday, Scottish Appeal Court judges delivered more bad news for Boris Johnson over his decision to suspend Parliament ahead of the October Brexit deadline.
Each opinion expresses the view that the advice given by the government to Her Majesty the Queen to prorogue Parliament from 9th September to 14th October was unlawful, and that therefore the prorogation itself is unlawful.
Opposition parties say parliamentary business should be resumed immediately, and the case moves to the UK's Supreme Court next week. But what does this judgment actually mean? Chris Hanretti is Professor of Politics at Royal Holloway, University of London.
One of the most surprising parts of the ruling, or at least the summary of the ruling that's been published so far, was the language used in the decision and the way that the judges were happy talking about egregious abuses of the standards expected in public office. Something like egregious abuses, that's really strong for judges. You know, that's almost like a judicial swear word. On one reading of what they've decided, they're saying that the Prime Minister's misled the Queen. And that's obviously quite a big deal, because even though we might all think that we know that the Prime Minister's motive was really to deprive Parliament of time necessary to debate Brexit, it's one thing knowing that or suspecting that. It's quite another thing having judges in a court of law say that. There are two separate cases on this issue of prorogation. There was one case which was filed in the English courts, and another related case which was filed in the Scottish courts. And it was the English courts which went first, and they announced their decision that plaintiffs in that case, Gina Miller and others, had been unsuccessful. So when the English court reached its decision, that was expected, and a lot of people, and I include myself in that group, a lot of people thought that the Scottish courts would follow in the same direction. They haven't done that. There are lots of people who are talking about how Scottish law has a slightly different legal tradition, different background to English law. And that's true, but I can't see much signs of it in the court's decision, or at least those parts of it which have been published so far. I think it's just possible that if you get three judges in one court and three judges in a different court, they will reach different decisions. And that's why we have a Supreme Court, after all, to try and reconcile these differences between judges at lower levels. If the Supreme Court, when it hears this case on Tuesday next, does decide that the decision to prorogue was unlawful, that's really going to be very interesting indeed. I would assume that Parliament would come back. It would mean that the wheels had utterly fallen off the government strategy of trying to keep Parliament away from oversight of the government's preparations for a deal or no deal exit. I think some MPs have already tried turning up in the Chamber of the Commons.
We're all going to be returning to our offices. We're going to go going back inside the Palace of Westminster because we're here. We're ready to work. We're here, ready here.
Over the past week, whenever I've thought that things were about to calm down, there's been some new issue that's exploded. So it may be that we'll have other exciting things before Tuesday. There is an additional Northern Irish case where we're expecting a judgment to come down perhaps by Friday. So that might also be controversial because that case involves different claims relating to the Good Friday Agreement. So there might be some further legal developments, but I am principally looking forward to a very packed Supreme Court courtroom on Tuesday.
That was Chris Henretti. You can keep up with the Supreme Court hearing next week on The Guardian's Politics Live blog. That's all for today. Thanks to Oliver Lachlan and Chris Henretti. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.